We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're dead on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for May the 19th, 2009. Rather wet, wintry day here in Sydney. Welcome to everyone who's joining us via live streaming from around the world on the 2GLF website. And don't forget, you can listen to this program later on our website, www.dadsontheair.net. Should be a particularly interesting show today. We've got, first up, we have Ian Plimer. He is a climate change skeptic. He's just written a new book called Heaven and Earth. And then we range across a wide variety of subjects. We then go on to perjury in the family court. We'll have James Adams from Fathers for Equality talking about moves to wind back measures which were introduced to try and stop the high level of false allegations within the family law system. As well, we'll be talking with Andrew Lyons. He has He is a high school student from South, a high school teacher, sorry, from South Australia, and he's developed a program called The Right Journey, which is all about getting boys into adulthood. So that should be a really interesting program all up. And don't make the mistake of thinking that Andrew Lyons will be dry, because it's a really, really fascinating program that he's devised, and should be really makes a really interesting, really interesting. Now, there has been a report out of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia talking about the moves to merge the Federal Magistrates Court and the Family Court. The press release reads, last Tuesday, the Attorney-General announced that the government had decided to accept the recommendations of the Semple report, it was called, and the budget, the federal budget, reflected the proposed abolition of the Federal Magistrates Court and its integration into the structures of the Family Court and the Federal Court. So, for those who haven't followed this closely, the Federal Magistrate Service was set up by the previous Howard government, the Conservative government here in Australia, and it was meant to be a faster, quicker, simpler, and often fairer family law thing. It handled a lot of the family law cases, and while it wasn't seen as perfect by any means, it was seen as a much better alternative than getting bogged down in the culture of the family court. They, the Shared Parenting Council, wrote that the opposition believes the decision is a grave mistake, and Brandis, the George Brandis, the shadow Attorney General, said that in our view, if the Rudd government proceeds with its plan to abolish the Federal Magistrates Court and drive all family law cases into the more expensive family court, the result will be increased costs, longer delays, and less accessible justice. And it's been a huge issue in the family court for years, the extensive delays and the leisurely pace at which cases are conducted. And, of course, the more leisurely it becomes, the quicker the status quo sets in, and the more likely fathers are not to see much of their kids. The Federal Magistrates Court was established by the Howard government in 1999, and its purpose was to take pressure off the other two Commonwealth trial courts, the Federal Court and the Family Court, by creating a lower-level court to deal with smaller cases while freeing the hands of these courts to concentrate on larger and more complex cases. The Family Court's come out strongly in favour of the Shadow Attorney General's views on this matter, and I think there would be a lot of concern around the country about the abolition of the Federal Magistrates Service, for the simple reason that while it wasn't seen as perfect by any means, it was seen as faster, simpler and fairer. But of course in Australia there's been a lot more exciting things than the merger of courts going on. We've had a footballer in the spotlights. And we might emphasise that we're going to listen to Ian's views on this matter. These are not the views of Dads on the Air. They're the views of Ian Purdy, who's in the studio with us today.
Well, yeah, and you don't even have to listen, really. But, I mean, let's face it. Well, we've got a classic case here. We've got the feminists and the prudes have declared war on football players. This situation that's emerged with Matthew Johns and the alleged, you know, group sex event that took place in a hotel room in Christchurch in 2002, which is, of course, shock, horror, all those football players. Oh, my God, they had group sex with a girl. Well, shock, horror. Well, people, there's nothing actually wrong with having group sex. It's not illegal. Some people might consider it to be immoral, but it's a fetish, I think, is a fair description of people who want to have group sex. They're fetishists. There's nothing illegal about it. It may not be your cup of tea. It's not my cup of tea. But people who wish to indulge in group sex are entitled to. There's nothing in the law. There's nothing anywhere to prevent adults who are consenting from getting together in a group and all having sex if that's what they want to do. And all of this prudish garbage, I mean, the fact that they've dragged Matthew Johns, destroyed his career, destroyed his family. I mean, I just think this is absolutely ridiculous. The guy has done nothing wrong. Okay, what he has done is not tasteful in most people's description, but personally, I consider what goes on in gay men's bedrooms to be a lot more distasteful than group sex between consenting heterosexuals, but I don't judge. You know, that this is perfectly acceptable behaviour in the 21st century. We accept people's right to indulge their sexuality in whichever manner they see fit, as long as they are not hurting anybody else and as long as they're not forcing other people to participate who do not want to participate. Now, this football story, we had this Kiwi girl, 19-year-old at the time, who was identified as Claire, who apparently went to a hotel room with Matthew Johns and another rugby league player and agreed to have sex with them. And then the rest of the Sharks football team kind of lined up and down the hall, and they all had sex with this girl who, according to her co-workers, was boasting about it the next day. She was saying that, you know, it was great, and she had sex with the whole team, and it was really fantastic. And then, of course, this came back to her in a wave of recrimination once all of her family and friends, because, of course, Christchurch is a very conservative, close-knit, small New Zealand community. And, of course, once everybody in this very conservative community found out that this girl was having sex with whole football teams, well, her reputation would have taken an absolute dive. And I would suggest that it was probably after she realised, after her mother or her father or somebody close to her confronted her about the allegations that she'd had group sex with a football team, at that point she may have felt remorse and become suicidal. This is my thinking on it, that any normal person who thinks that having sex with a football team is going to get them, you know, some kind of esteem in the community is a bit silly. And I think this girl, that was probably her main mistake, was imagining that other people would think that she was achieving something, whereas all she's done is basically bring down a whole bunch of men. And this idea that they should all fess up, I mean, it's rubbish. I mean, you've got to face facts that the rugby league community is a separate tribe existing within our society. They have different rules. I mean, we can't say that an accountant or a banker leads the same lifestyle as a rugby league star. I mean, it's just not realistic. And they don't obey the same rules. They are a separate tribe within our society. They provide us with entertainment. We accept a certain amount of unusual behaviour from them. And my contention is that group sex is not outrageous and unusual enough to warrant destroying these men's careers and jobs and shaming them as if they've committed some crime. They've committed no crime.
There is a view in the Daily Telegraph by one of the women that we're talking about that does enjoy her time with the footballers and basically commenting on it.
Yes, I have it here in front of me. True Confessions of a Rugby League Groupie, written by Shermaine Pahlavi, who also appeared on the Four Corners program, which exposed this ridiculousness and which has turned all these otherwise respectable members of the community. Matthew Johns is holding down a job. He's a television commentator. People do like him. I don't like him. I don't watch the footy show. I personally couldn't care less about it either way. But I just find the way that the feminists and the prudes have ganged up on football to be disgusting, and the fact that Four Corners, for showing this program and bringing this stupid, dysfunctional girl's point of view in there and allowing her to attack these men over something that happened a long time ago and that realistically everybody should have just forgotten about by now. And of course it had a bad impact on her, because I don't think she realised the effect of doing such things would have on her life when she admitted it to all her friends and family and it all came back to her. And then of course she got very depressed. I mean, there are women out there who like group sex with football players. This is a fact. They are part of the football players' tribe. They have a different code of behaviour to us so-called normal people, and we just have to live with it. There's no point shaming them over what to them is normal behaviour.
Well, a lot of people are saying that, that you know, it shows very low respect for women and so on. What do you think of those arguments?
Yeah, but the women have very low respect for the men as well. I mean, this is the values of this tribe. They don't value each other on an intellectual level. They value each other sexually. They value bodies. They value healthy, strong, fit bodies, the women and the men. From this point of view, they're all the same. As long as they don't drag people who don't want to be involved in group sex into their activities, then there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing that society should have. We have a right to have our nose in every football player's bedroom in case they go to bed with, God forbid, two women instead of one. I mean, this is prudishness. It's taken to a ridiculous level. It's had a shocking impact on the lives of Matthew Johns, for one, and no doubt all the other football players who everybody's trying to shame, calling them cowards for not confessing. This is absolute rubbish. These guys have done nothing wrong. They've broken no law. Okay, it was a tasteless thing to do, but hey, they're rugby league players. Come on, wake up, people. Yeah. This is what happens in the 21st century.
And it's even gotten to the stage now that the NRL is talking about getting rid of all the cheerleaders.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is just overreaction, knee-jerk overreaction to a ridiculous contention. Four Corners, the media who have blown all this up out of all proportion, should all be lined up and shot. This is absolute rubbish. There's no news here. I mean, it's been a dead news week. You've just got to look in the paper. There's not a lot going on. Yep. And to blow this story up from an incident that happened 5-7 years ago, you know, they're just scraping the barrel. It's pathetic. You know, it's and getting the, you know, the, all the wowsers and the prudes of the community to jump up and down and go how disgusting it is that these rugby league players have. I mean, wake up, people. Mind your own business and get a life.
Absolutely.
There you have it, mate. That from my point of view. And stop filling my television airspace with trivia and garbage, which really I don't care about. I don't care how many, you know, rugby leagues players have sex with how many. I couldn't give a damn. And I think most people are like that. As long as they play well when they're on the field and they don't urinate too much in public, Willie Mason.
Good on you, Willie.
Yeah, good on you, Willie. Big Willie flopping it out wherever he can. But as long as they don't do that, I mean, we've got to accept they are a tribe within our society. They are a subgroup. They live by different rules. They have different lives. They have different life experience, and we can't judge them by the standards that we would judge an accountant or a lawyer or a banker or some normal person who holds down a normal job, isn't adored by fans, doesn't get paid a ridiculous salary that is completely unjustifiable for running around a paddock kicking and throwing a ball, people. That's what these people do. They are not role models. Did the ancient Romans expect their gladiators to be role models? I don't think so. These people inherit the tradition of the gladiator. Okay, they're not killing each other, but they come a bit close to it. And that's the tradition that they're in, that particular tribe of human beings. And to judge them by the normal rules of so-called normal society is pathetic, childish. There you go. That was my rant.
Well done.
We'll be back.
We'll be back after this break.
I don't belong. Some days I don't.
stone sinks a kiss. Arms outstretched, but I can't reach him. Some days I want to run. Some days I want this. Like a stone sinks a kiss. Arms outstretched, but I can't reach him. Some days I want to run. Some days I want
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the air.
And with a bit of luck, we now have Andrew Lyons on the line. Are you there, Andrew?
I am, John. Can you hear me this time?
Yeah. Look, it's absolutely fascinating, this whole thing that you've developed called The Right Journey. I wondered if we might start at the beginning. You're a high school teacher in South Australia, and what was it that originally drove you to this, basically?
Yeah, John, I graduated from my study as a physical education and English teacher, and went out to teach in an independent school here in South Australia that was pretty middle class, I guess. And I was just surprised and a bit shocked by the boys that I was coming into contact with at the school. I sensed some sexism and racism and bullying and things like that that were evident from viewing them out in the yard, from having discussions with them in the classroom, and even in reading creative stories and essays that they were writing in English classes. And I began to wonder who the adult male in their lives was, who might be letting them know that really what was going on was a little bit inappropriate. And at the same time, I was reading Manhood by Steve Bidoff, and he proposes that teachers play a co-parenting role in boys' lives, and talks about how important teachers are as mentors. And it was at about that time that I put the two things together and thought, well, maybe I'm the person who should be, or who could be, guiding these boys into respectful adulthood. And so that's when I started to think about how, as a teacher, I could do that best.
Right. And so just explain to our listeners exactly what The Right Journey is. I understand it's pitched at kids around, or boys around 14.
Yeah, The Right Journey is a program which has the twofold. It has a curriculum content which looks like lessons in a class, and then there is also an overriding framework, a rite of passage as such, which is called The Right Journey. And that framework uses seven steps, ceremonies, to celebrate this transition point from childhood into beginning adulthood. And that's why we've chosen, one of the reasons that we've chosen around about the 14, 15-year-old age group.
And Indigenous cultures, this is absolutely the norm, isn't it? Or tribal cultures,
yes,
around the world.
Yes, yeah. The West is one of the few cultures that doesn't have this process.
Did you come to any understanding as to why that is so, why we don't do this?
The research that I did that it tried to look into why we have lost that, one of the things that I've come up with in the recent past has been this advent of what we call adolescence, which historically wasn't a part of our culture. But probably 50 or 60 years ago, a child would go to school and then leave school at around about the age of 15 and go and work in an adult world with adult interaction and mentors and be expected to be responsible like an adult. Over the last half a century, what has developed is this period of life called adolescence, where young people are leaving school but not actually stepping into the adult world and taking on adult responsibilities. And so what we see is a large chasm, I guess, forming, which is adolescence. And not only are people staying at home longer and not getting taking up this adult responsibility until later in life, but in the other direction, biologically, children are also maturing earlier. So we have this growing expanse of adolescence.
And it is probably extended too by the education system, isn't it? That,
yes.
They graduate from high school and they often go on to university or other sorts of colleges and so on. So
yes.
There's this really extended period where they're not working or living on their own or any of the normal adult things.
Yeah, that's right. I have a fellow called Richard Rohr, who is a Franciscan monk, has written a piece called Boys to Men, Rediscovering Rites of Passage for Our Time. And he has a quote that says, "It seems that it is only the recent West that has deemed it unnecessary to initiate young men. Otherwise, culture after culture felt that if the young man were not introduced to the mysteries, he would not know what to do with his pain and would almost always abuse his power. It looks like they were right." And so I guess having a process that actually works with young men in understanding being an adult male and working them through some of the issues that might have evolved, but also sharing my own journey as a man with them is proving to be really worthwhile to the boys and proving to be quite sought after, I guess, around the country as we try to work out how we can assist this process into adulthood a little more strongly as a society.
Now, I understand at this point in time it's only in some private schools, is that right?
That's right. At the moment it's running in private schools, with our first state school training is going to be happening later this year in July, where we're going up to Maryborough in Queensland to train the state school up there. But there is growing interest from the state schools, but at the moment it's the private schools who have the ability to, I guess, dictate what goes on within their own school that seem to be taking it on a little more quickly at this point.
Would the teachers' unions and so on be against this?
I
fairly strong feminist slant in these unions.
One of the two significant things I've noticed through speaking with quite a number of schools over the last couple of years are, firstly, that when I explain the right journey, most educators get it. They understand the reasons behind it. They appreciate that this year 9, sort of 14-year-old year at school, is one that we really grapple with in education as to how we work with that aged child when seems to be a year that really there's not a lot of progress made academically, and quite widely in educational circles there is this question about year 9 and what can we do.
It's called the middle years, isn't it? And there's been a lot of controversy about the wasted middle years, basically.
That's right, yes. So there certainly is that element of an understanding that it's really important. But the other issue with schools is the pressure on the academia and the standardised testing and benchmark testing and those elements, which mean that teachers feel this significant pressure to focus on the academic learning at what I have seen in my experience as a teacher, at the expense of the social-emotional learning. And so that's where there often seems to be some resistance in a school, is working out whereabouts the time comes from to sort of run such a program that does require probably about 3 lessons a week in most schools is how it runs. So there is that pressure on meeting these benchmarks and the academic criteria, which is a bit of a hurdle in some schools.
Right. Well, can you just explain what happens, how you conduct these courses?
Yeah. The program runs over 1 year, and the curriculum content is taught in class. And what happens is, in a co-ed school, for instance, the boys will be taught by a male teacher, and the program does run for girls as well, and they will be taught by a female teacher. And we've broken down the 4 terms of the year into 4 themes for the boys and the girls. And the first theme is the relationship with self, and so there is an exploration of who they are and an exploration of living as their gender as well, and what that experience is like, and how that's constructed, but also what they feel the expectations of living as a male in our society is. The second term looks at relationship with others, so that moves on to exploring how we get along, exploring communication and listening. If we start feeling angry, what we do with that anger in relation to other people, and also starting to explore sexuality. The third term is relationship.
How does that go, sorry, amongst teenage boys? They usually just giggle, don't they? Or what? How do you stop?
I have had the experience where they have giggled. But by the time we get to that stage of the course, they're starting to recognise the significance of what is going on, and the respect that grows between the teacher and their students as well is strong. I tend to use actually a book of short stories called Call It Love by Dean Blacklock, and I actually read the boys' short stories about love, and we then discuss sexuality and relationship in the context of those stories. So we talk about the characters and what choices they made, and perhaps if there were some other choices that could have been made. And I found that to be a really effective way of exploring sexuality and love and relationships. And they've handled that quite respectfully as well.
And, I mean, most boys, you know, a lot of teenage boys are pretty monosyllabic. How do you get them actually to talk? You know,
my
the famous
experience
grunting
has,
teenage yeah. boy.
But my experience has been that with guidance, and so the students have a guidebook. So if I talked about at the end of about the first 5 weeks, the boys all share their story with the class, and that process begins with going to find a talking stick that we use to have the respectful sharing that's important, and then we sit down in a circle outside somewhere and we share our stories. I share my story first, and then we go around the circle. For that to occur, there has been preparation for up to 5 weeks beforehand, where they have worked through a lot of questions and discussions using the guidebook, and that then sort of becomes the template for them sharing their life. My experience with the boys has been that they are very happy talking about themselves, and they're also very happy, I have experienced, sharing about the experiences that we talk about throughout the Right Journey. So I haven't had the experience of having the grunts and the monosyllabic conversations with the boys. I believe that they recognise and respect the process that goes on. So it's been I've just found it really rewarding and emotionally moving at times with what these boys are sharing.
And what exactly do they talk about?
We ask them in this particular process at the start of the year where they tell their story, we ask them to talk about the happiest moments of their lives, the dark moments. We ask them to explain what they think some of their strengths are and what their passions are, but also what they wish they could do better. They often like talking about crushes that they've had in primary school and first girlfriends and things along those lines. So they really seem to enjoy the opportunity to share, but also to hear the other stories from the class, and it's a wonderful way to begin building the group dynamic at the start of the year.
What if you've got a gay boy in the group? Do they get picked on, or...?
Depending. I haven't experienced that, that there has been someone who the rest of the class would be aware of that process. I think when we come to the sexuality part of the program, we certainly talk about homosexuality, and the boys share their own personal views, and I share my view, and that's a really important part of the year, I believe, through that sexuality unit, where we are trying to combat a lot of the prejudices that they have come up against probably in their early years, and perhaps really haven't questioned or heard other perspectives about.
And is the necessity for this, which you see, partly because of an absence of male role models in these kids' lives?
Yeah, when I was first of all considering doing the program, part of the process of that was recognizing that it was in my home group at that time. A number of the boys' dad wasn't at home with them, and for some of them they had little contact with dad, and for others there was a stepdad around, and they just didn't seem to respect him or communicate with him. So it really did come from feeling that there was an absence of adult males playing a role in their lives, where they were helping them understand being male and developing into a respectful and responsible man.
Do you think this is made worse by the low number of male teachers, particularly in primary schools?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And John, when I asked the boys how many male teachers they've had through primary school, by the time they have finished primary school, the average for the boys I teach is one year with a male teacher.
That was my son's experience, and that guy in primary school, he had to stand up in front of the whole school. This is a primary school, and tell everyone he was off to the Mardi Gras and how important it was for him. And I just didn't think kids of that age could really care less what he did in his own time.
No, it's certainly, you know, that age where post 7 and through to 14, where really in society, we're wanting the men to come forward and to begin working with these boys and helping them in their development. And if the schools are largely female teachers, then it really is a difficult process. And that is certainly that, and then the lack of adult males around as well for these boys in family life for some of them. Yeah, that's certainly one of the things that's important.
We're talking with Andrew Lyons. He's developed a new program called The Right Journey. It's for young men turning, or young boys turning into men. We'll be back in a moment.
Agony etched into every ring. A paperwork pile.
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back. Look, we've talked already about, we're talking with Andrew Lyons. He's the, he's a high school teacher from South Australia who's developed a program called The Right Journey, which is helping young boys into adulthood or into being men. Now, we've talked a fair bit about the beginning of the course. What happens after that? What happens in the second half of the year,
John, we move from sort of looking at relationship with themselves and looking at relationship to others to starting looking a little bit bigger. And the third term is relationship with life or relationship with the spirit. And it sort of just starts to explore what boys' beliefs are. And one of the really exciting processes in that term is the solo camping experience, where the boys spend 24 hours by themselves, isolated in a spot with just sort of a ration pack and a journal. And that process is built up to through a unit that's called Stillness, Silence and Solitude, and it's that acknowledgement that in the young people today live in this technologically saturated world with drenched. Yeah.
My son downloaded 1,000 songs from somewhere yesterday, you know. Oh, downloaded 1,500 songs yesterday.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So the purpose of this particular unit and the solo experience is working out what happens when the headphones come out of the ears and we remove them from a screen and it's just them. And what do they think?
But that's a shock for some of them.
Yeah, it is. And it's a shock for parents as well. They found that some parents find that process quite difficult of releasing their boys for a night out. But it really is, it's a wonderful process. And the feedback from the boys about that and the solo experience is always very, very strong. And they learn from that.
What do they say about it?
Well, they acknowledge that we talk a lot about challenge during the year, and they really acknowledge that it is, that for a lot of them it is a big challenge. They are amazed that they can do it. Firstly, one of the things that a lot of the boys think is that they just can't, it's just not possible to have that time without at least a novel or a magazine, but let alone a computer game or a mobile phone or an iPod. So they surprise themselves with that, but they really enjoy the experience of being by themselves and out in nature. It's sort of it's very, very common for them to love that experience.
And they would never have been for anything like it, would they?
No, typically not. No, it's very rare for any of them to have done something like that. In fact, it's very rare for most males to have had that process.
Right. Now, there's a fair bit of ceremonial aspect to this, particularly in the final stages, I gather. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, the ceremony does run throughout the year. One of the other element other than the curriculum, which we've been talking about, is, of course, this rite of passage process. And in searching for a contemporary way to acknowledge this sort of rite of passage, I use the seven steps of a hero's journey. So there's a calling and a departure, as well as a following and some challenges, and an abyss, which is the biggest challenge, which is actually the solo experience. And then we have the return, and then the homecoming. So there are seven processes through the year. Most of those have some sort of ceremony, which I would work with the staff when we do the training for them to create a ceremony that's specific for their school and their area. So, for example, the calling ceremony, we tend to encourage schools to take their boys to a landmark nearby, maybe a high point if there is one, and that is where the teachers call the students on this journey for the year. A departure ceremony, which is usually a parent information session, And the real point of that is actually asking the parents to give their blessing to the teachers to work with their son during that year, and all the way through to the return and the homecoming, which are at the end of the year and are really important acknowledgement of what has gone on throughout the year, and I guess a sending off, in a way, a sort of symbolic returning of the boy to the family, but then also a blessing for them to move off into beginning manhood.
And you do try and involve the dads quite a bit, don't you?
Yeah, we do try to involve the dads from simple ways of just simply setting discussions for the boys to have. So if we have talked about expressing emotions in class that day, then I will encourage them to go home and have a word with dad or the male caregiver about when the last time they cried was and what their experience of growing up with that adage of boys.
And do you find the older blokes receptive to all of this, or they just grunt back at their grunting teenagers? Sort of
partly because, John, at the start of the year we have this departure ceremony, which is the parent evening where the dads and caregivers come along to that. They're aware that they're going to be called on, and we make it clear that it's actually a really important part of the process is their ability to communicate and to share. And a very common thing when I have the fathers come up and shake my hand and say, Andrew, you have our blessing to be working with our son this year. They just lament that they didn't have a process like that. It is very, very common for dads to say, gee, I wish there was something at school when I was a lad like this. So they really do appreciate the process and I think really yearn for something similar themselves.
Look, we've covered a lot of issues around boys' education over the years, and of course there was a major federal government inquiry into boys' education recently, and that did really highlight the obstructive nature of some of the education unions towards these issues.
Yeah.
They didn't see that there was any problem with boys' education. They didn't see the disproportionate numbers going into tertiary education as a problem, and so on. Now, have you had any of those sorts of difficulties, or you don't think that's a relevant thing?
Again, I think that the issues that I believe face schools implementing something like this are really the pressures on teachers for the academic, but also do they really see the value in this? My experience has been that in all schools where there are some very passionate staff about that who would like to run the right journey, is that there are blockers and there are staff there who don't see the value in such a process. But I am glad to say that in nearly all those circumstances that these passionate teachers who'd like to provide this process have overcome and actually it is getting into the schools, which is just a real...
Is there a gender aspect to that? Do you find the women teachers more hostile or more... I would have imagined a lot of women teachers with sons of their own would welcome it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there is a real, an obvious difference in the gender approach to that, but I think that it's becoming, well, when I first started this particular process, I felt like it was quite alternative in a way, but I believe that it doesn't feel like that anymore. I think that it's becoming more accepted, and that in society in general there is this acknowledgement that we need to be doing more with the people in this age group. And I think given, you know, even the recent issues in the NRL, and we look at these role models for boys and where are they getting this education on how to be a respectful and responsible male, and who's sitting down with them and having the conversations when things like this come up in the media, I just find it's a wonderful opportunity with my class to sit down with the boys and say, look at this article, let's read through it. Now, what do you feel about this? What do you think about it? And to share with them and help them interpret this and what does it mean for them as boys and males.
Now, there is a website for people who want more information about the right journey.
Yes, yeah, the website is the right journey, with the important thing with that spelling right, R-I-T-E. All one word, therightjourney.com.au.
So it's therightjourney.com.au. And look, we're out of time, but is there anything way you would like to sum up the program? What, for instance, impacts do you see on the boys themselves?
I notice with the boys that they really mature throughout the year, that they open up, and I guess the really one of the significant things I see is a real authenticity in themselves and a strength. And perhaps one of the most practical ways I see that is their ability to walk tall and actually look me and others in the eye. And I think that certainly is part of that process into adulthood and being able to stand firm as their own being and human on this earth. So, yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. That's www.therightjourney.com.au. So it's right, R-I-T-E, therightjourney.com.au. We've been talking with Andrew Lyons from South Australia. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
It's my pleasure, John.
Really fascinating. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye then.
Stress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437. or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with James Adams from Fathers for Equality. You there, James?
I am indeed. How is the team going?
Oh, we've had our few technical difficulties, as they say, this morning, but we're doing fine.
It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, dear. Now, look, the Fathers for Equality put out a press release about this push by the Family Court and the Chief Justice, Diana Bryant, to push back prohibitions on lying in court, essentially. I wondered if you could background our listeners on the whole dispute. Before you die of...
You're right there, James.
It's a bit like that. It's a... Yes, under the Liberals, John Howard, the new Feeble Family Law Act did actually make some differences and did make the world a little bit fairer and a little bit better for children. One of the reforms was a clause that says, in the case where, in a situation where the magistrate, the judge, is pretty sure that that someone is making a false allegation, and intentionally making a false allegation, then the court can choose to punish the liar by awarding costs against the liar. Now, this is fairly common in other courts. It's called perjury. It's lying under oath. It's telling fibs. Now, this clause went through with the new Family Law Act under John Howard, and now the current government, with using Diana Bryant, is in the process of preparing to remove it. Firstly, it's highly inappropriate that a change in legislation should be being pushed by a judge. The whole point of a judge is to enact the law, is to act upon the law, not to create the law.
To the High Court.
So that's the background. At the moment, the legislation says if someone intentionally lies in court, the judge can consider penalising that person for committing perjury. And there's a push now coming from many quarters to remove that clause.
From what clause?
And that's what this press release is about.
From women's groups, essentially. Is that right?
I beg your pardon?
It's women's groups who are trying to get this clause removed.
It's women's groups in the domestic violence industry, the ones who profit from allegations and false allegations, the ones who make up statistics about how many battered women there are, and the ones who deny the truth about how many battered men there are. It's that crowd.
Right, and so what you're saying, they have an unreasonable influence over the Chief Justice, or what? I mean, why would someone who's supposed to be above and beyond all these things suddenly be buying into it?
Well, the main point is, what is the effect of these proposed changes? And at the end of the day, what would be the effect is more harm to children. These changes would damage children. At the end of the day, if you lie under court, if you lie under oath in court, what you're doing, is, particularly the family court, what you're doing is giving the court incorrect information to make decisions upon the child. If the court doesn't realise that you're lying and it makes decisions where the child lives, what the child does, etc., based on lies, then the court's going to be making bad decisions and children are going to be damaged.
Considering the court made good decisions in the first place. Yeah.
Decide on the best interests of the child, and if those decisions are based on a lie, then it's not going to be the best decisions. So lying in court means children are damaged. Or another way of putting it, lying in court is a form of child abuse. Lying in court is making sure the court gives you what you want, not what's best for the child. And that's what these proposals by Diana Bryant and her other nasty friends are trying to do. They're trying to hurt children so that the effect of them would be to hurt children, because the court would be less likely to be able to make good decisions for children.
Well, why is she doing this, James? I mean, what's her motivation? You know, she can't just be going into her bag of feminist platitudes and, oh, here's a, you know, well, let's slap them down again. I mean, there must be something behind this. There must be something rational.
The logic that they use, or the public expressions they say, is that if there's a possibility that any woman ever anywhere in the world would get any punishment for making an allegation that is not proven, then that will discourage other women from ever making allegations. And consequently, some, in theory, some abused women will not have their justice.
Not come forward, yeah.
Not be protected.
Do you think there's any credibility to those claims?
I can't believe... Well, considering the vast billions of dollars of money spent on telling everyone that domestic violence is unacceptable, it's illegal,
men are violent bastards,
it's only men that do it. I can't believe there's any credibility to that argument. But it's a tried and tested argument. It presses all the fear buttons in the female, in a section of the electorate. And
because what?
The nasties believe it hand on heart. Protecting women is more important than protecting children is the underlying... is the underlying belief, even though they'd never admit it.
Of course, the court is not known as the Palace of Lies for nothing. It's often, it really...
it's also been known as the Feminist Court or the Divorce Court. It's certainly not the Family Court because it's about the destruction of families.
It's a much reviled jurisdiction. We did ask the Chief Justice on just recently. She did come on some years ago, but she declined our kind offer. And,
really? What a surprise. These are people who are in very powerful positions, who manage vast budgets. And an example of this I just saw a couple of days ago was the ambassadors for White Ribbon Ambassadors. White Ribbon Camp Day, White Ribbon Campaign is basically saying men are abusive and women are victims, and there's virtually no good men in the world. And they had a list of hundreds of ambassadors who were all, significant business or political or sporting figures. And I just looked at those list of names. I worked for a PR firm a few years back, and I work for a newspaper now, and it's amazing how much work it takes to get that number of spokespeople for a movement. That list of advocates, of ambassadors, cost
hundreds of thousands of dollars
just to put that
just to organize
list of volunteers together.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Millions and millions and millions of dollars.
And
the number of professional
feminists that are out there. It's unbelievable. Whereas Dad's on the Air is so generously funded to the tune of nothing.
Things haven't changed, no.
at the end of the day, what the family court is pushing for changes to family law, which is wrong, A. B, the changes that it's pushing would remove the possibility of punishing people who lie under oath, and C, lying under oath in the family court is paramount or is a form of child abuse because it means the court's going to be making decisions that are not in the child's best interest because they'll be decisions based on lies.
Now, you've said in your release that Diana Bryant wants to override the will of the Australian people and the will of Parliament and to completely remove all disincentives against lying in the family court. Why do you say that? What's the background to that comment?
Because what she's pushing for is to change the legislation. And the legislation was put up by the government at the time, the Liberals, and she's wanting to get the new government to change the legislation. So there she's overriding or trying to override the will of the people through our democratic processes, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It's an inappropriate thing for a judge to be doing. As I said, the judges are meant to be
enacting the law, not
creating the law. They're not elected, they're appointed.
They're supposed to be an independent adjudicator. They're not supposed to come into the court with a preconceived agenda that they'll apply to whatever case they're hearing.
Which is another thing that's happened quite recently, is that is the destruction, which, or the, and it's going to go ahead, the destruction of the Federal Magistrates Court.
Yes, we did want to talk about that. We might talk about that in the next segment, actually. We'll come back in a moment. We're talking with James Adams. He's from Fathers for Equality. We'll be back.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with James Adams from the group Fathers for Equality. Welcome back, James.
Good to hear you guys again.
Now, the Shared Parenting Council of Australia has just put out a media release saying that, or basically condemning the abolition of the Federal Magistrates Court. Does the Fathers for Equality agree with that stance?
The Federal Magistrates Court, the previous government, the Liberals under particularly Ruddock, realised that the Feminist Court or the Family Court was... had many procedures and staff and precedents and so on that were counter to justice and the best interests of children. That's why it's been nicknamed as the Court of Lies, the Secret Court, or the Feminist Court, because it takes a very strange view on custody matters and matters of divorce. The assumption of innocence doesn't exist in that court, for example. If there's an allegation, it's worked on the assumption that it's true.
I've personally witnessed judges ridiculing fathers from the bench, and I'll just tell this story one more time. I was in the back of the court, I had a reporter's pad on me, I was obviously a reporter of some kind or taking notes, and this judge was going hammer and tongs at this father, and the father had written in an affidavit, "I was very sorry not to be there when my son attempted suicide." He was a 15-year-old boy and he attempted to kill himself, and mother had sole custody and couldn't see his father, and he attempted suicide. And so the judge was ridiculing him, going, "So you wanted to be there to watch, didn't you? Didn't you?" And he didn't just say it once. He kept this up for like 5 or 10 minutes, just ridiculing this bloke. And he kept going, "All I said was I would like to have been there to comfort him." And he said, "You wanted to be there to watch, didn't you? Didn't you?" That was the worst case I've ever seen. But I understand that those sorts of things are really quite common.
That's disgusting.
Oh, unbelievably disgusting.
And it's just so perverse.
Oh, I know, because it's so secretive, and there is no normal accountability in this system.
And that's a big part of the problem, that the court-appointed experts, like the court-appointed psychologists and the child advocates and so on, they're all vetted according to their feminist credentials and their family and father-hating credentials. There's no unbiased...
normal people.
...chance of getting a fair trial in the feminist court. So what Ruddock did, since the Magistrates Court already existed, Federal Magistrates Court, said, right, well, some family law matters or divorces can go instead of the family court, go to the magistrate's court. And the magistrate's court is a normal court with normal judges who have the normal rules and behaviours that you'd expect from judges. You know, the rule of law, they read the legislation rather than their own prejudices. Their staff are not indoctrinated by feminist ideology. There's an assumption of innocence until proven guilty. You have the ability to face your accusers, you know, and cross-examine your accusers. It's and all this good stuff. The whole thing, the legal precedents that go back to the Magna Carta, they're all there. And so Ruddock moved family law so that the magistrates' court could hear and has been making some very good rulings on child custody. What it does is provide an independent court to keep the bastards in the family court honest, so to speak.
I have seen some fairly poor judgments out of the federal magistrates. I mean, they're not perfect by any means.
Oh, certainly not, but you know, there's been a couple of cases now where, for example, an alienating mother, a mother who's insulting and hurting and destroying the relationship between a child and the child's father, that has the magistrate's court has ordered that the child get majority or sole residence with the father. And that's a wonderful judgment. It's saying that if you sabotage your child's future by sabotaging their relationship with their other parent, then for a period of time you will lose custody in order to fix up, give time for that relationship to be repaired, and to show as a gesture that, you know, this is not acceptable behaviour. Now, no one's suggesting that sole custody is a good model, but sometimes a short period of sole custody is the best way to keep people in line. It's a bit like no one believes that jail is a good thing, but sometimes jail is a good thing in order to tell people, and certainly the threat of jail is a good way of stopping people breaking the law.
Now, I just wanted to look at this Shared Parenting Council release very quickly. They write that under the Federal Magistrates Court, determinations were now reduced to a matter of weeks, effectively lowering the emotional and financial cost to parents and providing improved child outcomes on a massive scale. And of course, we all know that it could take years to get anywhere in the family court process. Mind-boggling, you know, the adjournments.
And there's a method to that as well. I mean, the longer... Yeah, they
force you to settle at the door.
Immediately, in the interim orders, say mum keeps the kids almost always, by the time you get a final ruling it can be 2, 3, 4 years later, by which time, you know, the children have adjusted to not having a father, and then the status quo kicks in. So, you know, even if a quick decision is a decision that helps children, a slow decision is a decision that helps the lawyers and the mothers.
Now, Geoffrey Green, who's been on this show quite regularly and came on last week, said the
Geoffrey Green, QC, thank you.
No, that's Michael Green.
Oh,
Geoffrey Green is a... spokesman for the Shared Parenting Council. The fact that 79% of all family law cases are now dealt with in the Family Magistrate Service demonstrates the phenomenal success this court has achieved in such a short period. One would be foolhardy and stupid to abolish a court that has achieved such enormous success, providing swifter dispute resolution at a reduced cost and achieving better outcomes for parents and children.
Well, that just points out the hypocrisy, because the people who are pushing for the abolition of the federal magistrates' court, not the local magistrates' court, federal magistrates' court, are saying, "Oh, well, having two courts doing the same matters is inefficient." Well, actually, it's as Geoffrey Green points out, it's doing it a lot more efficiently, and the waiting times and the decisions are made much more effectively, much more efficiently, quickly, using much less resources, costing the families a lot less money, and at the end of the day, a fast decision based on the rule of law is a good decision.
Yes, he went on to say that family breakdown represents one of the most significant emotional distress any person can experience in their lives. What kind of government could ever consider adding additional burdens and extending the emotional distress of parents to satisfy some unsustainable, unsupportable ideological position? The Shared Parenting Council will oppose this measure in the interest of justice and for the benefits of parents and children. The prospect of asking parents to enter into a demonstrably more complex, less efficient and more expensive family court is the worst possible option available to the Rudd government and they would do well to heed the opposition's cry to leave it alone.
What about the best interests of lawyers?
Well, I was thinking exactly that, Ian. It's a long court process is the court, the process that feeds the lawyers the most.
And, of course, lawyers, I mean, you know, they're very poor, underprivileged people. I mean, they need us all going in there and having our lives destroyed for their entertainment and gratification so that they can get rich off us. I mean, it's you know, we are providing a service for lawyers, all us families who allow ourselves to be put through the meat grinder of the family court.
Which is one way forward in this stuff, and that is, you know, at the end of the day, 50% of lawyers in the in divorce law are representing fathers, and yet divorce lawyers as an industry are very pro-feminist, very anti-father, very anti-family, very anti-shared care, generally because it creates conflict and that's where they get their money from. But there must be a financial incentive that we could organise that, you know, put together an endorsed list of family lawyers that are advocates of shared parenting and advocates of fathers. And we could use them for PR work and for, you know, and we could send clients in their direction. If we can turn this into a money-making exercise for a proportion of lawyers, then we'd suddenly have a balance. We'd have some lawyers that are feminist and some lawyers which are pro-family.
What's your broader view of all this? Are you surprised by the rapidity with which the modest reforms of the previous government are being turned back by a left-wing Labor government?
I'm not at all surprised. I'm perhaps surprised how they're only nibbling around the edges. The section that Diana Bryant's trying to change was argued against by the Greens and the Democrats and the left of the ALP quite forcibly in Parliament and in the Senate. I remember hearing Senator Seward of the Greens, Senator Scott Despoja of the Democrats, and I can't remember his name from the ALP left, all speaking against the possibility of punishing liars in court. So you can't punish liars in court. We oppose these. So they were strongly, even, you know, while the legislation was being pushed through in the Senate, they were strongly opposing punishing liars. And so it's to be expected. At the end of the day, families are not supported by feminists. And in fact, feminists, nasty feminists, are probably more anti-woman than they are anti-man. The one thing the feminists hate more than a man is a happily married woman. It's a hero myth. It's the underlying motivation. It's a hatred philosophy. It's a jealousy philosophy. And if you meet some of these women, and you will in a couple of weeks' time, John Stapleton, you'll meet McKinnon. What's her name again from Adelaide? The Council of
Solomon. Oh, Elspeth McInnes.
Elspeth McInnes.
McInnes. Oh.
She's
we haven't even mentioned this. There's a forum on at Parliament House on the 16th of June. Is that right? Are you speaking at it as well?
Warwick Marsh
and Parliament Foundation. Dad's on the Air will be there. This is on the 16th of June. And I think we've all been given about 20 minutes each to put our case. And Peter Vanderford from Dad's on the Air, he'll be there as well. And not sure, we might even get Phil York from Dad's in Distress there. We'll try. And but anyway, we'll be there. And there's a number of other groups. Elspeth McInnes from the Council of Single Mothers, Warwick Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation, Kathleen Swinburne from the Lone Parents Union or something like that. Is that what it's called?
That's Soul Parents Union, yeah. I think.
All of whom receive vast amounts of public funding and no doubt their airfares will be paid for by the taxpayer, and we'll be spending our own money to get there and won't be paid.
Yeah, well, it's another example of what the new government have done, in that they, unless they've managed to squeeze some money out somewhere, the only funded fatherhood and family supporting group that we have in Australia that has sufficient funding to pay a wage was Dad's in Distress.
Dad's
in Distress, and their funding was not renewed by the current Labor Rudd government. And I presume that they're just going to have to cut back on services and rely on volunteers. And
yes, we've repeatedly asked the minister responsible, Jenny Macklin, to clarify whether or not that funding has been cut, and they won't even give us an answer. It's a fascinating example of democracy in action. They can't even be bothered answering an email.
It reminds me, quite a few years ago, more than a decade ago, I was working on a suicide prevention kit. Federally funded, we sent this out to school counsellors, youth suicide, school counsellors and social workers and youth group organisers and, you know, police citizens, youth clubs and things. 30 pages of information written by feminist-inspired suicide workers trying to decrease suicide rates. That was the purpose. It was funded by Reach Out, federally funded. The money went to Reach Out, and we were doing this work for Reach Out.
And what, the fact that the highest divorce rate is amongst males of the divorce age bracket was entirely overlooked, was it?
Not only that, but you know, the official statistic at that time was for every woman who dies through who suicides, five men successfully suicide. 5 to 1. Mm. The highest risk factor for suicide is maleness, full stop. If you add to that the vast numbers of suicides that are recorded as accidents, like most drug overdoses are recorded as accidents, but certainly not all of them are. A lot of car accidents where you're in a straight road doing a stupidly fast speed, they hit the only tree for 50 kilometres in the country.
The highest
That's hardly an accident. They aimed at that tree.
The highest drowning rates are amongst males of the divorce age bracket. They just swim out to sea.
Yeah, and of course, farmers who accidentally shoot themselves while climbing through the fence with their 303. And there are a lot of reasons why country coppers and country magistrates will put accidental shooting rather than suicide. Life insurance won't pay out. Catholics can't get buried in the, you know, Catholics that die in sin and suicide's a sin, don't get buried in the churchyard and so on. And to protect the families.
All right, we're out of time.
So anyway, this kit designed to stop youth suicide, and the highest risk for suicide, probably 9 out of 10 suicides are male. Probably 9 out of 10. This kit talked about males, and there's 30 pages of information on two occasions. One, it talked about gay men.
You need to wind up, James. We're out of time.
Okay, so suicide is a man's issue, and they're happy to let men die.
That's a good wind-up.
Because they're feminists. They're nasty, nasty feminists.
And don't forget, you can see more of this debate and these debates in New South Wales Parliament House on the 16th of June.